That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient. Comfortable. Ah.
Ah.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Hello and welcome to The Price of Football, the show that looks at the money behind the beautiful game with me, Kevin Day, and Liverpool University's Kieran Maguire. We're recording this just before the big kickoffs on Sunday. A lot of important issues to resolve, lot of money at stake, and more crucially, whether Palace finish ahead of Brighton. I mean, morally, we obviously are, but it's nice when the league table agrees, Kieran, isn't it?
Well, it's all really we've got to look forward to from today. So I'd like to say may the best team win, but I'm far too shallow for that.
Well, also you should say may the better team win, Kieran, because it's a choice of two, but that's neither here nor there. As you can tell by that grammatical correction, Kieran, I'm a donkey on the edge this morning because I woke up outraged that Ukraine didn't win Eurovision. Ali's just as cross that Iceland didn't win, and Ed's really happy because Italy did win with a shocking, terrible, fake heavy metal. Never mind, we take it too seriously. It's questions day, Kieran, but we have one interesting news story before we get into them, and it could be the first crack in the gambling dam that we have been predicting for some time.
Yes, this relates to Preston North End, and they are currently sponsored by 32 Red, who are also the sponsors of Derby County, and they've sponsored some other clubs historically in the past as well. And that relationship is ceasing. And looking at the comments coming from Preston, and this is something which I think some other clubs have hinted at the past. We do have clubs such as Luton Town and Tranmere Rovers who take the view that football sponsorship by the gambling industry is unhealthy and unethical, and therefore they don't have anything to do with it. We've seen Everton move away from their gambling sponsors, and now Preston are doing this. And I was talking to a commercial director of a football club who said there's a case for jumping before you're pushed, because if the government brings in legislation which prevents front of shirt sponsorship, and if they do, I think actually the gambling industry will think that it's got away with an awful lot, because compared to the amount of money that the gambling industry spends on advertising on television and radio, front of shirt football sponsorship is relatively minor, and also that many of the big players in the gambling industry, you know, the likes of Ladbrokes and William Hill and Paddy Power and so on, well, that they don't have individual club sponsorship as such, so it makes zero difference to them. So that's where we are. Preston have made the decision. Talking to this commercial director, what he said was, for many clubs, the gambling companies, they might be the biggest payers in town, but they're not the only payers in town. And by getting out at this stage, Preston are more likely to be able to sign a deal before the overall level of prices potentially drops if legislation is introduced.
I did know about those other clubs, but the introducing the story is the fourth crack in the gambling dam wouldn't have been quite as dramatic. questions, Kieran, and the first comes from Alex Scott. Alex Scott asks, how is the money generated by radio commentary of football split? The BBC and TalkSport cover all the big games, but there is rarely any coverage of Leagues 1 and 2. Do clubs from all divisions receive a set amount each season? And how is it? If so, how much extra revenue do the teams receive from a featured match? And of course, smaller teams will feature on BBC Radio Devon or BBC Radio Humberside or, in your case, West Sussex. But it is a good question.
It is indeed. There are separate radio broadcasting deals from, first of all, the Premier League has one for its rights, and it has seven packages, which the BBC have four and TalkSport have three. And all of that money goes into a central spot, a central pot, should I say, and that is split equally alongside the money from the Premier League's main sponsors, such as EA Sports, Barclays, Budweiser and Nike. And that's worth £100 million a year in total to the clubs in the Premier League. So they get around about £5 million each. Now, trying to work out how much of that's coming in respect of radio isn't possible to determine. That the Premier League are a little bit coy on that. But, no disrespect, a big club such as Liverpool or Manchester United will actually receive the same amount as the smaller clubs in the Premier League. Mm-hmm. And the reason for that is that the radio companies, the broadcasters, they do not dictate which matches are taking place in each individual slot. That's actually determined by BT and Sky. So therefore, there's no merit payments as such from a radio point of view. But when it comes to the EFL deal, and that is that's an exclusive deal with TalkSport. Again, that goes into a central pool of money, and that is distributed.
I'm having trouble hearing you. You're right.
If that was Finlay, then Finlay is really getting clever, isn't he?
he's a very advanced dog. Yes.
Yeah. It's slightly sinister, the fact that is it Siri or Alexa or both?
This one's Siri.
All right. I know what you're like. I wouldn't put it past you to be seeing Alexa on the side as well.
Yeah. Well.
Carry on. Talk to
Siri. Siri is my only company this morning because the Baroness is dealing with the mother of all hangovers and is therefore...
I'm not sure I understand.
Siri doesn't know what a hangover is. Okay. Was it a Eurovision party that the Baroness was taking part in last night?
Well no, because it was our first chance to go out for an indoor meal since breakdown. So we went out for a meal which lasted about 3 hours and finished with... the Baroness appeared to be, you know, and I know nothing about alcohol. You know, she appeared to be drinking Guinness from a cocktail glass, but she told me that this was something called an espresso martini, which looks remarkably similar. Now, I've got absolutely no idea, Kevin, so I'll have to leave it to the experts.
Knowing the Baroness, I would say it's more likely to be an espresso martini, but I can confirm, happily drink Guinness from a cocktail glass if needs must. But,
back to TalkSport, yes. TalkSport have the exclusive rights for radio in terms of a national deal with the EFL, and that is split. 80% of that goes to clubs in the Championship, 12% to League One, and 8% to League Two. And then individual clubs will sign individual deals with local BBC radio stations. But from my understanding, we are talking peanuts in terms of the amounts involved.
Ben Gardner says that Kieran mentioned recently that Premier League footballers use image rights as a way of avoiding income tax. I was wondering, says Ben, whether, as part of a solution to the current financial crisis, it would be feasible for a new tax to be imposed specifically on these forms of income and revenue. It seems reasonable that those who profited most during the fat years should be expected to contribute in the lean. I'm amazed, Kieran, that producer guy allowed that sort of dangerous socialist thinking through his golden net. He must have been concentrating on lighting his cigar when that question went through.
Yeah, it's an intriguing one. I do feel that the football industry gets an unusual amount of attention in respect of the amount of remuneration paid. If you take a look at the average club in the Premier League, it has a wage bill of £156 million. Mm. Now, if you compare that to one bank, such as Barclays, £8.1 billion, so it's 50 times as many. Tesco's, again, £7.5 billion. So there are many, many other companies in the UK which have huge amounts of remuneration. And
the BBC and the BBC and ITV for a start off.
Yeah. And also, from talking to people who do work at the BBC, many of whom now have to go and set up their own supply companies. And that's the case with many employers who are use people on a freelance basis. Mm. So and all of these have tax implications. In terms of footballers, HMRC broadly say we are reluctant to allow you to have more than 20% of your remuneration going through as image rights. And yes, that can lead to a reduction in income tax paid. But if we are going to do that, then I think we've got to take a look at the much broader issues of tax planning and to single out the football industry when I know people working in the world of finance who have very, very sophisticated means
of course.
Not paying as much tax as they would do under alternative arrangements. So, yes, could the government bring in legislation? Yes, it could. What would happen as a result of that? Our silver-tongued friends would get together, set up a WhatsApp group, and I can assure you they will run rings round the revenue. There is always a way to reduce tax paid, and I don't think that the football industry is one of the worst offenders in respect of that. So could it be done? Yes, but I think it would be a sledgehammer to crack a nut to a certain extent, because the much broader issue of tax avoidance on a corporate and also in terms of those, Ben says, there have been people that have profited or have been become very wealthy on the back of COVID and the pandemic. I don't think they'll be paying huge amounts of tax because of the way the system works.
But also, it goes right back to a subject we discussed, I think, in pod 2 or 3, Kieran. It's a psychological aspect, and it's your friends in the financial industry. People think it's fully deserving that they earn a lot of money, of course, and they think it's clever when they find ways of avoiding paying the full tax on it. People think it's vulgar when footballers and comedians earn a lot of money, and they think it's outrageous when they... It's just a difference in the way people are perceived in this country. And as you say, at the moment, more or less since Matt Hancock, right at the start of the pandemic, compared footballers' wages to PPE in a totally useless comparison. There's been so much focus on footballers' wages at a time when other people are on furlough, etc. And it is unfair, as you say. There's a question from James, talking of COVID. Just James, no surname. James says, were there any actual positives to buying a football club at a time when no fans were allowed and everything is still in a pandemic recession? Why would anyone make the decision to buy a club when the present is still pretty bleak and the future is uncertain at best?
I think it's if I was a billionaire, I think there is no better time to buy a club. So perhaps producer guy might be listening into this. and the reason is that we're operating in a depressed market. So you can buy clubs at a discount, both in the UK, but in continental Europe. So the asking prices have fallen because existing owners are effectively willing to give some clubs away for a pound, because it means that they're not having to write out that check every single week for significant losses. So that's Yeah, that's one benefit. You can buy a club at a discount. And then also from a recruitment and retaining talent point of view, wage costs are depressed. So especially in Leagues 1 and 2, I'm hearing reports from agents saying, well, you know, the player wants to stay, but the club's saying you're going to have to go and take a significant pay cut. And we're not getting the alternative offers that we might have had 12 months ago. So it's market forces. And, and just as it's market voice forces why some players in the Premier League are paid millions upon millions, it's also market forces that are driving down wages at the lower level. So, I think we have to accept it at all levels. The transfer market in the lower leagues will collapse this summer as well. I saw QPR's accounts come out yesterday. They spent £55,000 in a full season in the Championship signing players. We're talking about a Championship football club. So, we're already starting to see the financial forces come through. I think there are positives. We have seen the recent takeover of Sunderland. We've seen the recent takeover at Wigan. You can buy clubs relatively cheap. You can recruit players relatively cheap, especially if there's many players who are out of contract. I think it's the Sunday Times rich list is out today, and the Forbes rich list has come out, and it said it's never been a better time to be a billionaire because... there's an awful lot of additional wealth for those people that are operating in certain sectors of the economy who have benefited either directly or indirectly as a result of COVID.
Mm. It turns out the guy is so wealthy, he's managed to buy his way off the Sunday Times rich list as well. So he doesn't want the publicity. Well, of course, I mean, the thing is as well, Kieran, if you're a billionaire, it you don't worry about Brexit or COVID because you're insulated by your money, aren't you? It's the best vaccination of all, isn't it? £1 billion when there's a pandemic going on. Ben Graham says, imagine this scenario. It's 3 a.m. in a Blackpool nightclub and wrong scenario. I turned over two pages. Sorry about that. A player is in the last 6 months of his contract, so should be able to speak to another club. But say that player has a clause stating that once they pass X number of appearances, they get an extension at their current club. If that elusive X happens within the last month of the contract, does that then impact on their ability to sign a pre-contract agreement to join another club? I don't like using impact as a verb, but it works there. And also, I prefer the 3 a.m. in a Blackpool nightclub scenario, but we've talked privately about how that one played out, Kieran. So let's stick to Ben's scenario, which is an interesting one. And first of all, I know this is more legal than financial, but again, this is one of those things that we all assume that every player in the last 6 months of his contract is then free to speak to another club or do a pre-contract arrangement.
Yes, well, I mean, what would have to happen under these circumstances is that the club would have to trigger that contract extension. And we've seen that quite often at Manchester United, who have had players who are coming towards the end of a contract where there is a plus one option. And the club have said, you have played the matches. We're going to trigger that, and therefore you're now committed to the club. And that could actually, from a financial point of view, and I still feel genuinely uncomfortable about the way that we commodify football players.
Yes.
Because we're supposed to be have freedom of employment, but clubs will do this in order to protect their own interests, with the view that if you are in the final 6 months of the contract, you can effectively walk away for nothing on a Bosman allowing the player to satisfy the conditions on the contract, triggering the contract extension. It means that the player might still leave in the summer, but this time the club gets a fee. So it is an intriguing scenario. But it would effectively prevent the player from being able to walk away in the summer and, get a higher signing on fee from the next club, assuming, of course, that the player is the suitable calibre that he's going to be in demand. There will be many players, I can assure you, again, in the lower leagues, who would be absolutely delighted if the club had triggered these conditions in contracts, because it gives them certainty. And remember that we're talking about young men, many of whom have young families and mortgages and so on, just like, you know, many other young people. And it gives them a greater degree of certainty going forwards in terms of their own personal circumstances. There's going to be an awful lot of players scrabbling around for relatively few positions over the course of this summer.
James Rushmore has a question on a similar theme. And James says, lots of clubs loan players with an option or obligation to buy. For example, my club, Norwich City, have an obligation to buy Ben Gibson and Dimitris Yiannoulis. Now they're in the Premier League. But what would happen if they simply decided to ignore that obligation?
They would get their arses sued, I think
is the
technical phrase for this. What would happen is that, you know, the original club would say, this is an issue. We've got a contractual obligation. You failed to do this. It would probably report them either domestically to the Football Association, the Premier League, or the EFL, and on an international basis, it would report them to FIFA. So I think there would be consequences. And also, I think the club itself would suffer reputational damage. You know, why sign up a player with a loan to effectively forced to buy on the basis of promotion if this club has a reputation for weaseling out of deals? You know, the word would get around. And it wouldn't happen for a club like Norwich anyway, who in my view are one of the most ethical clubs.
Yeah.
In football in the UK.
I suppose you could get some championship clubs who put a clause like that in the contract, not 100% expecting to get promoted, and then it comes as a surprise to them. But then I suppose they can't argue they haven't got the money because they've just been promoted, so they've got 140 million quid, haven't they?
We saw it at Brighton, where we loaned Anthony Knockhart to Fulham.
Yeah.
Fulham got promoted and they clearly didn't want him, but they had to go and buy him under the circumstances. And then he relatively quickly after that was loaned out to another club in the Championship. So it's a way of providing some protection for clubs that have just been relegated or who are in the Championship, that the worst case scenario is you pay a loan fee, and the comfort factor is that if you do get promoted, yes, you've got to go and pay some money out, but the chances are you can then start to move this player on yourself.
Yeah, I haven't forgiven Anthony Knockhart for that lucky goal he scored at Selhurst when he beat two players and curled it in from 25 yards.
We thought it was a fluke as well.
Yes.
I did that when I was doing handstands around the ground.
Ed Payne has an old school club. I got quite nostalgic when I read this, Kieran, because as I say, it's a proper old school club question. Ed says, as a Villa fan, when was the last time the club made a profit? We made losses every year under Lerner and nearly went bust under Z. So I reckon it must be 20 years since we made a profit. Is that some sort of record? Now, Kieran, I bet you loved researching this, didn't you?
Oh, I was in absolute heaven. I was like a skin muck going through this. First of all, Ed is absolutely correct. The last time that Aston Villa made a profit was in 2001.
Wow.
And they made a profit for the whole year of £138,000.
Wow.
Since then, they have lost money every year, and their average losses for the last 20 years per week, £588,000. £500,000 a week for 20 years when they've spent the vast majority of that time in the Premier League. Which is, you know, it's incredible numbers. And that, you know, Randy Lerner, Tony G, and also the new owners. I mean, the new owners have certainly backed the manager, and Villa's losses are significant. So I think it's a really good, first of all, it's from, yeah, from my point of question, I absolutely love researching this, but it's further evidence that the Premier League being paved with money for all concerned is a myth. Certainly there will be major beneficiaries who tend to be the playing talent. And I've always said I'm all in favour of young men earning large sums of money coming from working class backgrounds. What's not to like? I have no issue with that whatsoever. But the idea that the Premier League is full of profit as well is not the case.
Well, you've answered my question already, which again shows how we're getting too close, because that's the my one backup question. So they're going into a third season in the Premier League and we still can't expect them to make a profit. That just, it's so counterintuitive, isn't it? Well, it would be if I'd been doing this pod for 18 months, because certainly 18 months ago you would just go, well, of course they'd be making a profit. They're about to go into the Premier League for the third time.
Yeah, it's Sir Alan Sugar's legendary prune juice comment. It has never been truer. In the sense that as soon as additional revenues come into a club, then either the existing players and their representatives say, well, hold on, you know, we're the major, you know, we're the reason why people watch football, so therefore we have a bit more money. And also when you're recruiting players, their representatives will say, this is a Premier League player you're signing, so therefore, you know, the expectations are X million per year for my client, because that's the going rate, and the club, if they don't sign the player, somebody else will on a fairly similar wage level. So it is certainly at the Premier League level, the balance of favour, and you worked in HR yourself, you know that there's in any negotiation, one party is normally in a stronger position than the other. In the Premier League, it's still leaning towards the players, whereas in the lower leagues, I think it's now switched towards the clubs.
This episode of The Price of Football is brought to you by the AI-powered workspace Notion. We are living in an era of information overload, and we have more knowledge than ever before. But what do we do with it all? If you're in Notion, you put that knowledge to work.
It's a workspace designed not just for making progress, but getting inspired. And all I can say on a personal level, as for somebody whose life is quite chaotic, and I'm writing pieces for government and newspapers and media content, I've got my university commitments and I'm supposed to be writing a book, I use Notion all the time because it brings order into chaos.
Well, if you need order brought to your chaos, you can try Notion for free when you go to notion.com/priceoffootball. That's all lowercase letters, notion.com/priceoffootball, and start turning your ideas into action. That's notion.com/priceoffootball.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
Yeah, can you stop telling people I used to work in HR, Kieran? It was a long time ago, and it makes me sound like an accountant. my career has taken a much more glamorous turn in the last decade or so.
Absolutely. Sorry, I'll mention it again. It's a bit like when people bring up the subject to me, used to be a sex shop manager, and they thought it was far more glamorous than being an accountant. and believe me, it was.
Well, yes, it's all right for you. You haven't done it. You've done it the non-traditional way. You've shamed your family by going from running a sex shop to being an accountant.
I didn't shame my family because I never told my mum. And the reason why I became an accountant was because I didn't want to bring shame. When coming from a big Irish family, yeah, what's Kieran up to these days? Well, he's selling vibrators for a living.
I bet Uncle Terry was ashamed when you became an accountant. Well, a legitimate one.
Well, anyway. I don't know. Known a few things about the books. It comes in very useful.
Alan Marples has our next question, and it's an area we haven't explored before. So thank you for that, Alan. Alan's question relates to players who open their own coaching academy. For example, my club, Sheffield Wednesday, have a local player called Liam Palmer who runs one. Will these be a personal brand funded by the players, or do they feed into the club's academy? I remember as Kevin Keegan opened and closed an academy in Glasgow, I believe, didn't he? And said in an interview that one of the problems was it was people were confused as to where it lay within the sort of professional club system. So it's an interesting question.
Yes, I think as far as Liam Palmer is concerned, I think he's 29, 30, so he's looking potentially for a career beyond football. There's a lot of merit for starting to do some future planning. I think it's called the Liam Palmer School of Excellence. It does appear on the Sheffield Wednesday website, so it could be that they're utilising his name. I think a lot will depend upon the player himself, because again, you mentioned Kevin Keegan. I'm old enough to remember the Bobby Charlton soccer schools in the summer, where the player's name was used as a vehicle to attract people, to attract kids to attend these summer schools and similar. I think that what we might be seeing with somebody like Liam Palmer, he's working in conjunction with Sheffield Wednesday. I mean, there is a separate company which has been set up, and Liam Palmer is the director. So I was going through Companies House records this morning, after the rush I'd had on the Aston Villa spreadsheet, so it's a company which has been set up recently. So he would appear to be sort of the independent beneficiary of it, but I think there's opportunities for him to work in conjunction with Sheffield Wednesday as well.
Yeah, you would imagine Sheffield Wednesday coaches are probably helping out there as well. And it's a useful way for the club to spot young talent as well, isn't it, who may have slipped through the sort of more formal scouting recruitment now, I suppose. And speaking of which, Rhys Jones says that Bolton youth player Findlay Lockett has been linked with a move to Wolves, and he's a second-year scholar yet to sign professional terms with Bolton. So what kind of fee would Bolton expect to get in compensation, and how are these figures calculated for young players across all categories of academy? And this is a bugbear for many, many fans, Kieran, especially outside the Premier League, that they worry constantly about young players being taken away before they get to a situation where they can actually get a transfer fee for them.
Yes. So this is linked to our very good friend EPPP, Elite Player Performance Plan, I think is the official word for it, which gives a fixed form of compensation. Now, looking into the background of Findlay Lockett, originally, I think he was signed up by Burnley's Academy at the age of 8. And now he's at Bolton's Academy. He is Bolton Wanderers' second youngest ever player. Very sad for him. He's just had a cruciate injury, which is going to put him out for the rest of the year. So it looks as if I think the potential move to Wolves might therefore not be taking place. I think Bolton Wanderers are therefore making overtures to try to persuade him to sign a contract. They do think he's got a lot of promise. But the way that this would work under EPPP is as follows. Bolton are a Category 3 academy. Now, what happens is that you get a fixed amount of compensation based on how many years you have been involved in the player's development. So between the ages of 9 and 11, it's a fixed £3,000 per year. Between the ages of 12 to 16, it works out as £12,500 per year if you're a Category 3. I think it goes up to £40,000 a year if you're Category 1. So we're talking thousands rather than millions, but if that player then is signed by a Premier League club, so we are, let's nominally say we're talking about Wolverhampton Wanderers. If Finlay Lockhart signed for Wolverhampton Wanderers, Bolton Wanderers, after he'd played 10 matches for Wolves, would have got £150,000, which, given the size of transfer fees in the Premier League, is very modest. Even if he went on to play 100 matches, that would only rise to £1.3 million. So EPPP is quite controversial, because when it was introduced, it was seen at the time as a take it or leave it offer from the Premier League. We're going back quite a few years. Quite a few clubs have closed down their academies because they feel that the costs of developing players, they're not going to recover if the player moves on to a more senior club, because the levels of compensation are inadequate. So it's a very sensitive issue, and it certainly causes a lot of aggravation. And I know, Crystal Palace, historically, you've got the John Bostock issue.
Yes.
And we can understand. EPPP was supposed to give clarity, rather than going to an independent tribunal, in respect of the level of compensation. But it does look as if the levels are certainly skewed towards the club that's doing the recruiting rather than the club that's doing the development at a young age.
One of the great what-ifs, John Bostock, he was a fantastic young player. It's really, we were discussing this, we're going tomorrow night to Selhurst Park for the under-23 playoff final. We were there last Monday for the semi-final, for want of a better word, and just, it's all very, really good, talented young players. But four or five of them we will probably never see again, which is kind of heartbreaking, because they look brilliant to us, but they're not quite brilliant enough to make that level of football. And talking of Wolves, I guess it won't be too many pods before we're talking about how much Nuno Espirito Santo's new club is paying him wherever he goes, be that Tottenham or Madrid. Simon Plum says, as an Arsenal fan, I'm used to seeing players run their contracts out and leave for free. I don't blame the club. That's very good of you, Simon. I don't blame the club, because if you offer him a better contract and he refuses to sign, what can the club do? But if the trend continues of players running down contracts, will this not, in theory, drive transfer fees down, as clubs will become reluctant to risk no resale value?
It is a consideration, but what we are seeing clubs doing is that when a player reaches normally the last 2 years of his contract, then there will be the start of negotiations. And from the player and his representative, but also from the club's point of view, it is a game of sort of three-dimensional chess, because if you've got 2 years, let's say that you're on £100,000 a week, and the club offers you, with 2 years of your contract remaining, a 50% pay rise. So that's, you're guaranteed an extra £5 million over the next 2 years from your existing contract. You might say, well, yeah, £5 million guaranteed is £5 million in my pocket, less tax, of course. The alternative is that you play hardball and you start to run down the contract. Now, during that period, you could suffer a loss of form. Yeah, think about Alexis Sanchez. What happened to him? You could have a career-ending injury. It could be that you're actually quite happy at the club. Your family settle there. You've got a good relationship with the manager and your teammates. So extending the contract could be beneficial. And whilst footballers' wages is a topic which gets an awful lot of discussion, it's not the only reason why we work. I mean, I could earn a lot more money not being a teacher than I do, but I happen to enjoy what I do. So it could be that the player says, well, actually, I've got certainty here. My family's settled. I've got the opportunity to stay here longer. Why not take that? If we take a look at the likes of Ross Barkley, I think he sort of illustrates the issue that Simon raised. He potentially could have signed for Chelsea in August 2017 for £35 million. He was then in the last 12 months of his contract. He signed 6 months later for 15 million. So clubs are aware of the deterioration in the value of a player in that last 12 months. So that's why they are always keen to have players with at least 2 years remaining on a deal. But the player is perfectly entitled to say no. And then we just have to see how things develop.
Mm. You could always stay a teacher by day, Kieran, and go back to running the sex shop at night, Double Bubble, which I believe is one of the products you used to sell in the sex shop.
Yes, 30% discount using the code word price of football.
sadly, no shaving products anymore.
We've been binned, haven't we?
We have been binned, yes. It's slightly embarrassing being binned by a genital shaving product.
Yes.
It's not one of the highest points in either of our careers, really. Being sacked off by Manscaped. That sounds wrong in all sorts of ways, doesn't it? Our penultimate question comes from Samiran Colbert. Apologies if it's pronounced Samiran Colbert. There's simply no way of telling. I'm a long-suffering Stoke City fan. Oh, okay, Samiran. I wonder where my club sits in regards to FFP. Obviously, we have very rich owners, as discussed on this pod many times, so that's not the issue. But our manager, Michael O'Neill, keeps saying he can't buy players because of financial fair play regulations. I just don't want there to be a big fat points deduction at the end of any season.
Right. In terms of Stoke City, when they were relegated from the Premier League, the way that financial fair play works is that you're assessed on a rolling three-year period. So for every year you've been in the Premier League, you're allowed to lose £35 million, and every year in the Championship, it's 13. So the first year in which Stoke City were in the in the Championship, in the EFL, they were allowed to lose £83 million over 3 years. That then dropped to 61, and now in their third season, it's going to be 39. So that's going to be tapering down. Stoke City haven't published their accounts for 2020. Now, they're not alone in that, although they are in a minority of clubs. But I did get hold of a copy of the Bet365 accounts, who happen to own Stoke City. And in the small print there, and as you know, I enjoy a bit of small print on a Sunday morning, it said that Stoke lost £87 million in 2020, which is, you know, pretty substantial for a club that had a relatively modest performance. And Stoke also have, I think, according to my records, they got the most expensive squad ever assembled in the Championship, which cost £196 million. And I said earlier, you know, QPR's squad cost £55,000.
Yeah. So
it is very much the haves and the have-nots in that division, as it is in many divisions. Michael O'Neill is probably right, is that there's an awful lot of pressure at Stoke to get people out of the door before he can recruit. Remember that the financial fair play rules have been relaxed to a degree as a result of COVID, and that will work in the club's favour. Certainly when it was in the Premier League, Stoke was one of the better run clubs in the Premier League. But it's tried to effectively buy its way back into the top tier, and that has come at substantial cost. So there will be a major emphasis this summer at the Potteries to get players out of the club as quickly as they can.
And of course, the reason you have points deduction as a sanction is to avoid very, very rich owners just being able to pay their way out of any fine they get, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah. You know, if you are, remember, the owner of Stoke City earns more money herself than the most expensive Premier League club in the form of Manchester City. So, you know, the fines could just be swatted off if you are very wealthy.
Our last question, Kieran, comes from Mark Younger. And many of our dear listeners will be saying to themselves, well, we've already talked about this. We have, but I still can't quite fully grasp the answer. So I'm perfectly happy to ask Mark's question, which is, with all the talk about how much the Wigan administrators get paid, who actually paid them?
Right. Reading the report, the self-congratulatory report put forward by the Wigan administrators, they are very keen to emphasise that under normal circumstances, the administrator's remuneration would be subtracted from the value of the assets sold at the company involved. Now, if that had been the case, I think there would have been a genuine problem in terms of being able to pay the unsecured creditors at Wigan Athletic, the 25 pence in the pound, which the EFL insists upon, and fair play to the EFL for doing this, insists upon saying, well, if you don't do that, you're going to get a further 15-point deduction. It looks as if, from reading the small print, that there are other connected companies to Wigan Athletic, and the administrators' pay is coming from those and other clubs connected to Al Young, the mysterious owner of the club, who first of all, it's never been explained the rationale he had for buying the club, and also the rationale behind putting it into administration a few weeks later. Now, I'll explain exactly what he did to you after the show, but for legal reasons, I ain't putting my name on it during the show.
Oh, well, don't tell me, as I'll tell you, know what I'm like, I'll tell everyone, I'll just start tweeting, I'll start tweeting it. But it's a fair question, because this came up a long time ago, the first time Palace were in administration, this notion of who was paying the administrators on a daily basis, because there was some fairly conspicuous consumption from them. For example, the end of season dinner dance, as it was then, still went ahead, and the administrators bought three of the top tables for quite a lot of money, and it's one of those things where you think, hang on a second, where's this money come from? So somebody has to fund them on a daily basis. We know what happens when the club is sold and they get their share there, but they somebody needs to fund them on a daily basis, don't they? And that's why Mark's question is a good one, I think.
Yes, I mean, you know, under normal circumstances, especially if the administrators would have a good relationship with the bank, what we used to do, it is a few years since I last did this type of work. You would say to the bank, well, you know, this is how much we think it's going to cost us. The administrators often wouldn't actually they would pay from their other resources for many of the things, and then they would say to the bank, right, we've now sold all of the assets for, let's say, 10 million. Our fee is, you know, half a million, and we're now going to take the money. So they effectively sub during the course of the administration itself. And although the average hourly cost of running the Wigan administration is working out, including this mysterious one-third uplift they have, again, as part of their self-congratulation, oh, look, we managed to do our day job, we're going to give ourselves a 30% pay rise. Clearly, the staff involved don't get anywhere near the sums which are being used. So there's a huge difference between charge out rate and the actual cost of employment in respect of the individuals concerned.
Well, thank you, Kieran, and thanks to everyone who has recently become a patron of the pod via our Patreon site, including Andrew Kinross and Seth Kirby, who says, of my extensive list of podcasts that I apparently listen to, Price of Football is the only pod I play religiously. A tremendous duo. In the future, a football pub tour is needed. Don't worry, Seth, our producer guy, a.k.a. the Brian Epstein of podcasting, is way ahead of you. We will be looking to do some live shows, possibly opening for Swiss Ramble on our tour, No Sleep Till Moscow, and even less sleep in Moscow. So keep an eye out for that when all the restrictions are lifted. And if you want to make a small contribution to our always free-to-air podcast, then go to patreon.com/priceoffootball. And if you have any questions on any aspect of football finance whatsoever for Kieran, then it's questions@priceoffootball.com. And as ever, I shall hand you over to Siri, Alexa and Kieran to say his customary goodbye.
Well, once again, folks, thanks for all the feedback. Thanks for all the support. It genuinely makes a difference to us knowing that some of you, for reasons which we've never managed to fathom out, seem to be enjoying the show. If you could go to the Apple Podcast app and give us a review, give us 5 stars, apparently, according to the producer guy, it doesn't matter what you say. So just feel free to talk about whatever you want. It helps us in the charts. It's something to do with an algorithm, and that's about as much as we know. Other than that, it's the last day of the football season. We're recording this. I suspect the world of football finance might be ticking over the course of the summer. We've already got a few stories for Thursday, including why is Saudi Arabia proposing the World Cup takes place every 2 years?
Much more. That's a good question. It's one I've asked myself, Kevin. All right, bye, everybody.
Bye.
The Price of Football. Price of Football.